Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
I don't know about you, but I've often wondered what it would be like to see the American West as it once was. No highways or fences, no power lines or cities or railroads, no airplanes flying overhead, just a pure wilderness, completely untouched by modern man. And in the spring of 1805, that's pretty much exactly how the Corps of Discovery found it. A land teeming with game so gentle and abundant that Captain Meriwether Lewis reckoned it'd take no more than two good hunters to feed a regiment. And on that account, he was most likely correct. After leaving the Mandan villages back in early April, the expedition had followed the Missouri into present-day Montana and found themselves knee-deep in a hunter's paradise. Buffalo, antelope, and deer were all there for the taking, and they dined upon them all. Now, the buffalo were so numerous that the explorers would often have to chase them out of camp. Per Captain Lewis, quote, "We can send out at any time and obtain whatever species of meat the country affords in as large a quantity as we wish," end quote. To supplement this carnivore diet, they also partook of berries, wild licorice, and a type of root affectionately known as the Indian turnip, all of which were identified and collected by young Sacagawea, in addition to whatever other useful herbs or medicinal-type plants she happened upon as she walked the banks of the Missouri. Ah, but it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows. Although the Corps of Discovery was able to cross the entirety of the Great Plains without crossing the path of a roving war party, the same could not be said when it came to grizzly bears. They were first warned of these ferocious beasts from the Mandan, who told them that they didn't go hunting bear unless they had a party of 8 or 10 men, and even then, they painted themselves for battle in the same manner as if they were going to war. While I'm sure this gave a few of the men pause, I don't think they were initially all that concerned. After all, most of them had hunted bear back east, and I guess they figured that these bears in Montana would fall from a single musket round in the same way that them black bears did back in Kentucky. Turns out that would not be the case. On the 29th of April, Lewis and a few of the others managed to kill their first grizzly, one not yet fully grown that they estimated weighing somewhere around 300 pounds. And even then, it took more than one ball from Lewis's rifle to drop him. Less than a week later, Captain Clark did the same as he and Drewer put no less than 10 rounds in a grizzly who weighed at least twice as much as the one that Lewis had killed. And much to their eventual dismay, this would not be the Corps' last encounter with a grizzly. Far from it. Less than 2 weeks later, Private Bratton narrowly avoided a Mullen, and a few days after that, several of the men spied another grizzly on the bank and decided to exact a little revenge. Coming ashore quietly, the brave hunters crept in close as four of them fired at the exact same time. And although all four balls hit their mark, the bear showed no inclination of dropping. Instead, he reared up, let loose a bone-chilling roar, and came charging. Only two of the men still had loaded rifles, so now it was their turn to fire, and once again, even though both rounds struck flesh, that bear just kept on a-coming. The would-be grizzly slayers jumped headfirst into the Missouri, just trying to get away, but, as I'm sure you're aware, bears know how to swim, and this one in particular did not hesitate to follow them straight into that river. Finally, at just the last second, someone managed to reload and put a ball through the grizz's head. It's no wonder that Lewis would eventually write in his journal, quote, "I find that the curiosity of our party is pretty well satisfied with respect to this animal," end quote. Later on that very same day, near disaster struck again as one of the P-Rows piloted by Toussaint Charbonneau tipped over. As Charbonneau began panicking and crying out to the heavens, his wife, Sacagawea, coolly sprang into action and was able to save many of the expedition's valuable supplies, once again proving her weight in gold. Also, I think this, coupled with the most recent close calls with those bears, was a stark reminder to everybody that, although the hunting was good and the weather pleasant, they were not just on some leisurely stroll through the forest. This was a dangerous expedition, and unless anyone wanted to follow Sergeant Floyd to an early grave, they had best all be on their A-game. By late May, the Corps of Discovery was piloting its way through the Missouri Breaks, where Captain Lewis became the first American to ever witness a bighorn sheep, at least officially. And this is also where they first noticed the Rocky Mountains in the distance. To quote Lewis, "While I viewed these mountains, I felt a secret pleasure in finding myself so near the head of the heretofore conceived boundless Missouri. When I reflected on the difficulties which this snowy barrier would most probably throw in my way to the Pacific, and the sufferings and hardships of myself and the party in them, it in some measure counterbalanced the joy I had felt the first moments I gazed upon them." End quote. And yeah, as Lewis hypothesized, there was plenty of hardship and suffering to come, more than I think he could have possibly imagined. For now, though, they were still on the Missouri River, and the living was good, albeit slow going, thanks mostly to a combination of head-on wind, shallow water, and numerous twists and turns. Forward progress was further aggravated by coming upon a fork in the river and not knowing which one to take. This was actually a big problem. Remember, one of their main goals was to explore the Missouri River to its source. Also, based on the intel given to them by the Mandan and Hidatsa, it was the Missouri that would take them to the Shoshone and hopefully, knock on wood, Shoshone horses. Horses they were going to need to make it over them mountains looming on the horizon. And last, but certainly not least, if the expedition chose the wrong fork, they'd end up squandering weeks of valuable time having to backtrack and risk not making it across the divide before the winter set in. Sergeants were sent up each branch for several miles to do a little recon, but their findings were inconclusive, so the captains decided to split up with Lewis and five others exploring the fork to the right. Now, as it turns out, this was the Maria's River, not the Missouri, and luckily it only took Meriwether a couple of days to determine that it was indeed the wrong fork. On the way back to the main party, a little excitement was had as Private Richard Windsor slipped on some wet clay and nearly fell off a high cliff. As it were, he was barely hanging on when Lewis immediately went to his rescue. Quote, "Although very much alarmed at his situation, I disguised my feelings and spoke very calmly to him and assured him that he was in no kind of danger. To take the knife out of his belt behind him with his right hand and dig a hole with it in the face of the bank to receive his right foot, which he did, and then raised himself to his knees. I then directed him to take off his moccasins," that's Lewis's spelling, not mine, "moccasins, and to come forward on his hands and knees holding the knife in one hand and the gun in the other. This he happily effected and escaped." End quote. So there you go, Captain Lewis cool and collected under pressure. And let's not forget, he had saved himself in a similar manner the year prior. By June 8th, they linked back up with Clark at the fork and, after much discussion, determined that the South Branch was the best bet. This was not a popular decision, by the way, among the rest of the expedition. They, nearly to a man, thought that the North Fork was the true Missouri. Even Sacagawea thought so. Nonetheless, neither Lewis nor Clark would budge, and, to their credit, the rest of the party soon fell into line, saying that they'd follow the captains damn near anywhere they deemed proper. It was also decided that they would cache some of their more heavier items there at the fork, figuring that they could just dig them back up on the return trip. These supplies included the blacksmith's bellows, along with several tools, a few kegs of parched corn and pork, some rifles, 24 pounds of gunpowder, and one of the P-Rows. Also, if I'm not mistaken, this is where Lewis ditched what he called his experiment, a specially made iron boat frame. Now, this was actually pretty cool in theory. The collapsible frame weighed less than a canoe, but was capable of bearing an estimated 8,000-pound load of cargo. The idea was to cover it up with animal skins, then seal the seams with a pitch made out of buffalo tallow, charcoal, and beeswax. If successful, this would make portage and supplies over the falls that much easier. Like I said, the frame was collapsible and able to be broken down into pieces. The only problem was they just couldn't keep that son of a bitch from sinking. No matter what they did, no matter how they sealed the seams, water just kept getting through. So finally, Lewis just had it disassembled and buried. There is no further mention of this frame in the historical record, and so far as I know, it never got dug back up with the other supplies. Finally, on June 13th, 1805, the expedition reached the Great Falls of the Missouri and were finally satisfied that they had made the correct choice back at the fork. Although the Hidatsa had failed to mention the Big Fork, they did warn the captains about this waterfall, the first in a succession of five that would force the men to portage their equipment over land for the next 18 grueling miles. And when I say grueling, it took them 12 days just to travel 18 miles, okay? More supplies were cached, along with the other P-Row, as the men were forced to muscle everything else through the brush and prickly pear. According to Meriwether Lewis, quote, "They are obliged to halt and rest frequently for a few minutes. At every halt, these poor fellows tumble down and are so much fatigued that many of them are asleep in an instant. In short, their fatigues are incredible. Some are limping from the soreness in their feet. Others faint and are unable to stand for a few minutes with heat and fatigue, and yet no one complains. All go with cheerfulness. End quote. Now, I don't know about that. I kind of think maybe there was a couple of people complaining behind his back. Yeah, maybe a couple of middle fingers aimed the captain's ways, but you never know. On top of all of that, they were still getting buggered by the Grizzlies. On the 14th of June, Lewis was out hunting alone, and he had just downed a buffalo when he spied a large bear around 20 or so paces away. Considering that he had not yet reloaded his rifle, Lewis took off in the opposite direction. Wise choice, but can't no man outrun a grizzly, and the bear was quickly gaining ground behind him. Right at the last second, Lewis dove into the river and then spun around, determined to go down fighting with his trusty espontoon. Now, an espontoon, not sure if I'm saying that the right way, but it's sort of like a spear or a pike. Just a long wooden shaft tipped with a spear point. These had long been a military staple, and Merriweather had carried an espontoon in the army. Likewise, both he and Clark continued the practice during this expedition. Hell, Captain Clark had even managed to use his to kill a wolf. Luckily for Lewis, the bear decided that it wasn't worth the effort and lumbered away. Just like that, disaster was averted yet again. At long last, by July 15th, the portage over the falls was complete and the Corps was finally able to set out upriver once more, this time with two additional dugouts that they themselves had constructed. Unlike the iron frame, these did float. 10 days later, on the 25th, they arrived at the much-anticipated Three Forks, about 30 miles northwest of present-day Bozeman. Now, this Three Forks region is interesting, to me at least. Simply put, it's where the Gallatin, Madison, and Jefferson Rivers, all named by Merriweather Lewis, by the way, meet the Missouri and where the Missouri officially begins. Coincidentally, it was also the exact same place where, some 5 years earlier, Sacagawea had been captured by the Hidatsa. That meant that her people, the Shoshone, would hopefully be nearby. And make no mistake about it, a meeting with the Shoshone was absolutely critical to the success of the Corps. Remember, not only could they provide horses, but also much-needed directions as to how and where to cross the Rockies. In the meantime, the expedition worked its way up the Jefferson River, as, according to Stephen Ambrose, injuries and illnesses mounted. Captain Clark had recently been suffering from intestinal issues, and had also, quote, developed a tumor on his ankle, which was much swollen and inflamed and gave him considerable pain. Sergeant Gass, Charbonneau, and four or five of the enlisted men had various indispositions. Everyone was more or less exhausted most of the time, end quote. And yet they persevered, following the Jefferson to its mouth and then continuing on down the Beaverhead until, on August 8th, they reached what's known as Beaverhead Rock, a landmark immediately recognized by Sacagawea, who stated that they should run into her people any day now. As such, the captains began taking turns headed overland, searching for the Shoshone with small groups of men. So it were on August 10th, 1805, not far from present-day Grayling, Montana, when Lewis spied a young warrior on horseback far in the distance. Now, Captain Lewis only had three men with him at the time, Privates Hugh McNeil and John Shields, along with the always dependable George Drewer. Only thing was, they was all spread out. McNeil was with Lewis, but Shields was to the left and Drewer to the right, both of them out of shouting distance. As Lewis approached, the warrior in question began to look nervous, causing the captain to place his rifle on the ground and begin repeating a word he had learned from Sacagawea. Tabbabone, Tabbabone. It was supposed to mean white man, but truth is, I don't think anyone has been able to figure out just what in the hell he was truly saying. Historians nowadays think that it was possibly a word for stranger, but whatever the case, it did not help assuage the young Shoshone's apprehension. It wasn't long before Merriweather realized it was Drewer and Shields approaching on his flanks that was what was really making the lone Shoshone nervous. He motioned for him to stop, which Drewer did, but Shields just kept on a-coming. Once Lewis got within 100 yards, the warrior, still casting furtive glances at Shields, suddenly whirled his horse and galloped away. Lewis was angry, to say the least, and spent the next several minutes giving Private Shields a proper tongue-lashing and blaming him for scaring the warrior off. Nonetheless, they continued, rightfully thinking that even more Shoshone were soon to be found. The following day, they crossed over the Continental Divide into Idaho via the Limhi Pass, and what Captain Lewis saw likely sent a chill down that Virginia spine of his. Thinking that once he got to the top of the ridge, he'd see a wide valley below and hopefully the Columbia River in the distance, Lewis was instead greeted by even more mountains, the indomitable Bitterroots. Professor of Geography John Logan Allen had the following to say about the moment. Quote, imagine the shock and surprise, for from the top of that ridge were to be seen neither the great river that had been promised, nor the great open plains extending to the shores of the South Sea. End quote. Goes without saying that the Rocky Mountains sure as hell weren't the Appalachians, and all hopes of a quick and easy portage to the Columbia River were now thoroughly and utterly vanquished. Wasn't all bad news, though. The next morning, Captain Lewis was finally able to locate a small group of Shoshone. Two of them ran off as he and the men approached, leaving just an old lady and a young girl. Looking to make friends, Lewis gave the woman a few trinkets, and once she calmed down a bit, he had Drewer explain that they wished to be taken to her village. Before they could even get there, though, they were greeted by a welcome party of about 60 Shoshone warriors, armed to the teeth and prepared to fight. What happens next would not only rely on the leadership of Meriwether Lewis, but also the disposition of the Shoshone. They had Lewis and his companions outnumbered 15-1, and rifles or no rifles, the odds were not in the Americans' favor should the warriors decide they'd rather fight than talk. Just like he had done a couple of days prior, Lewis laid down his rifle before ordering the rest of the men to do the same and stand back as he and the old woman approached alone. As they closed ranks with the warriors, she began showing them all the presents that Lewis had given her, and luckily this helped to break the ice. In the words of Lewis's biographer, Stephen Ambrose, quote, the chief advanced, saying, "Ahai, ahai," which Lewis later learned meant, "I am much pleased, I am much rejoiced." The chief put his left arm over Lewis's right shoulder and applied his left cheek to Lewis's right cheek, continuing to frequently vociferate the word "Ahai." The other Shoshone soon joined in, and we were all caressed and besmeared with their grease and paint until I was heartily tired of the national hug. End quote. This chief's name, by the way, was Kamiawait, and after a quick smoke, he and the warriors led the way back to the main camp. Once there, Lewis and Kamiawait got to talking, or at least as much as they could, with George Drewer acting as an interpreter. Mostly, Lewis was trying to ascertain the best way across the mountains, and, according to Kamiawait, two of the nearby rivers, the Limhi and the Salmon, were next to impassable. However, there was a crossing to the north that the Nez Perce used when they came east hunting buffalo. Kamiawait said that the going was extremely rough, but I guess Lewis figured that if the Nez Perce could make it with their women and children, then it shouldn't be an issue for he and his men. Next, Lewis asked Kamiawait to accompany him back to Captain Clark and the main party in order to help transport their supplies up the mountains, a request that immediately set off alarm bells to the Shoshones. Due to recent troubles with the Blackfeet, they didn't think it was out of the realm of possibility that Lewis was a spy and somehow trying to lure him into an ambush. Now, it's important to note that at this time, the summer of 1805, the Shoshone were more of an uncontacted tribe than any other that the Corps of Discovery had thus far encountered. I mean, yeah, they had horses and a few European trade items, but that was about it. Out of a village consisting of 100 warriors, they had only 3 rifles between them, and they got these either through trade or war. The Lewis and Clark expedition was almost certainly the first people of European descent that this particular band had ever met. Their enemies, on the other hand, like the Blackfeet and Hidatsa, had obtained quite a few guns from British traders. That being the case, Kamiawait and his men had to stealthily sneak out onto the plains, make quick work of the buffalo, and then skedaddle back to the mountains before their better-armed enemies were alerted to their presence. Even then, just prior to the expedition's arrival, like I said a moment ago, Kamiawait's band had suffered greatly from a Blackfeet raid, as evidenced by their short-cropped hair and understandable paranoia at Lewis's request. And also, come on, they just met. How are you going to introduce yourself and then 5 minutes later ask somebody to help you move? Captain Lewis persisted, though, and to be honest, he got kind of pushy. Told the Shoshones that if they didn't help, then no more Americans would ever come to do business with them, and that they would never receive the rifles and gunpowder that they so desperately needed. He also appealed to their ego by asking if there were any among them who were not afraid to die. Now, I think that did the trick more than anything else. Finally, Kamiawait and 6 warriors agreed to accompany Lewis. By August 16th, they reached the forks of the Beaverhead, and lo and behold, Clark and the others were nowhere to be found. Once again, the Shoshones got nervous, so Lewis ended up handing his rifle to Kamiawait and instructed the chief just to shoot him dead if there was an attack. That there just shows how desperate he was to A, get the show on the road before the snow began to fly, and B, to gain the trust of the Shoshone. The following day, George Drewer and one of the warriors went looking for Clark, and luckily for all involved, they found him and the others rather than a Blackfeet war party. This fortunate turn of events was followed by yet another stroke of good luck. Once Sacagawea locked eyes on Kamiyawait, she went running over and threw her arms around him, crying tears of joy. Turns out he was her older brother. To quote historian James Rhonda, the stars had danced for Lewis and Clark. Now, I'm no historian, and this is no shade on James Rhonda, but I would personally add a once more in there. The stars had once more danced for Lewis and Clark. As dangerous and physically exhausting as the expedition was, you gotta admit, these dudes were just catching one lucky break after another. And now one of their own was a blood relative of the chief that they were trying to obtain horses and guides from. No longer would they need to worry about the Shoshones thinking they were allied with the Blackfeet, and the horses that they so desperately needed were pretty much all but guaranteed. All total, the Corps of Discovery would end up spending the better part of 2 weeks among the Shoshones, trading for said horse flesh and preparing for the next leg of the journey. Finally, on September 1st, the expedition headed out once more, this time on the backs of over 24 Indian ponies, their guide, a weathered and aged Shoshone they nicknamed Old Toby. Once again, this was very difficult traveling, up and down rocky and steep inclines, and pretty much blazing their own trail, according to Captain Clark, quote, through thickets in which we were obliged to cut a road, over rocky hillsides where our horses were in perpetual danger of slipping to their certain destruction, up and down steep hills, end quote. Hell, by September 3rd, it even began snowing. It was also on September 3rd that they ate the last of their salt pork. Nevertheless, they made it over the divide. The exact location is not known, but they most likely crossed using what's now known as Lost Trail Pass or Chief Joseph Pass. And the following day, nearby Ross's Hole in southwestern Montana, they met up with a band of Salish, yet another tribe that some thought were possibly descended from lost Welshmen. Now, I'm not really up on my medieval lore, but apparently there was a guy known as Prince Madoc, a Welshman, who, according to legend, had sailed to the Americas as early as 1170 AD. For the longest of time, people thought that Madoc and his party had intermingled with the natives and created some sort of Welsh Indian tribe. That said, from what I understand, there is no actual evidence that Prince Madoc even ever existed. Still didn't stop Lewis from taking special note of the Salish language, to later be compared to that of the Welsh. And yeah, I am aware that they speak English in Wales, if you want to call it that, but there is also a Welsh language. Anyway, you get the idea. No, there never was any lost tribe of Welshmen in the United States. At least not that's been proven. But during Lewis's time, this was still a very popular theory. From the Salish, the Corps was able to trade for additional horses and at least one mule before continuing to travel through the Bitterroot Valley, stopping to camp for a couple of days at a place that Lewis dubbed Traveler's Rest, about 11 or 12 miles southwest of Missoula. Finally, after a short respite, it was time to cross the Bitterroot Mountains. A task that not a single damn one of them was looking forward to, and for good reason. Not only was there no game to be found that high up, and no grass for the horses, but once again it began snowing. On September 13th, they crossed the Lolo Pass into present-day Idaho, and the following day, the 14th, they camped not far from where the Powell Ranger Station currently stands, about 20 or so miles southwest of Lolo Springs. That's also the day they had to kill one of their own horses just to fill their bellies. And from there, conditions would only grow worse. It snowed the entire day of the 16th. Lewis wrote that he was as wet and cold as he had ever been in his entire life. And they killed yet another horse, a young colt. This action was repeated the following day. Now, in the book Undaunted Courage, author Stephen Ambrose notes the following, quote, they were in what is today prime big game country. Out-of-state hunters pay hundreds of dollars for a license and an outfitter to hunt elk and bear in these mountains. But in 1805, such animals were down on the plains and meadows. They were driven into the mountains by the coming of ranchers and farmers. End quote. In other words, while there may be ample game in the Bitterroots nowadays, it was a whole lot different back a couple hundred years ago. Now, me personally, I've never been to Idaho or the Rocky Mountains period. But this is something I've heard and read about in the past, that by the early 19th century, the influx of settlers and the springing up of towns and cities, coupled with increased hunting pressure, had pushed the wildlife deeper into the mountains. Is this true? I've got no idea. But it does sort of make sense, and it helps to explain why these explorers were having such a hard time making meat up there in the Bitterroots. And just to add to the misery, most of them were also suffering from a not-so-fun combination of dysentery, skin boils, and the ever-present venereal diseases. Oh boy, don't say I didn't warn you that we were going to talk about this again. Now, just a word on these STDs. First of all, is it STDs or STIs? Back when I was in school, it was STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. But I'm getting old, and I think nowadays the kids refer to them as STIs, or sexually transmitted infections. Whichever it is, the two most prevalent there among the Corps of Discovery seem to have been gonorrhea and syphilis, both of which, from what I understand, are caused by bacteria. Gonorrhea in men can cause painful urination, pain or swelling of the testicles, and a pus-like discharge from the tip of the penis. Ugh. I didn't know this, but apparently you can also catch gonorrhea on other parts of your body as well, like in your eyes, your booty hole, your throat, even your joints. And while not fatal, left untreated, gonorrhea can result in infertility. As far as syphilis goes, it can cause painful sores that are typically found around the mouth or genitals. And without proper treatment, syphilis can affect your organs, your nervous system, and eventually result in death. A small percentage of people with untreated syphilis also fall prey to cognitive impairment, hallucinations, paranoia, and other mental afflictions. Additional symptoms include hair loss, sore throat, muscle aches, fever, and fatigue. So yeah, not only are these guys starving and freezing, but their peckers are oozing pus, their skin's breaking out with various sores, their balls are swollen, they're possibly hallucinating, and God knows what else is going on underneath them buckskins. Oh, and to top it all off, they had also ran out of whiskey a couple of months earlier. Like I said, not exactly a leisurely stroll through the park. And discomfort aside, the lack of food became so dire that Captain Clark and six others ended up pushing on ahead of the main group just to locate something to eat. Now that was on September 18th. The men just kept slogging on, and by the 21st, what Stephen Ambrose described as one of the greatest forced marches in American history was finally over. It had been 11 days and 160 miles since the Corps of Discovery left Traveler's Rest. Per Meriwether Lewis, the king of run-on sentences, quote, "The pleasure I now felt in having triumphed over the Rocky Mountains and descended once more to a level and fertile country where there was every rational hope of finding a comfortable subsistence for myself and party can be more readily conceived than expressed, nor was the flattering prospect of the final success of the expedition less pleasing." End quote. Also, even more good news, not only were the Bitterroot Mountains in the rearview mirror, but Captain Clark and those advanced scouts had made contact with the Nez Perce. He and Lewis reunited, and the Corps ended up staying with the Nez Perce for about the next 4 or 5 days, camped out near present-day Weipe, Idaho. Now, regarding this little feat that they had just accomplished, if, at present time, you were to drive from Traveler's Rest State Park in Montana all the way to Weipe, Idaho, it would take you about 3.5 hours. But if you get a chance, just take a look at that route on Google Maps. Okay, you're following Highway 12 almost the entire way, and there is absolutely nothing in between, other than some very rugged terrain. You're on national forest or wilderness land the entire trip. I cannot imagine what it would have been like over 2 centuries ago. I also can't imagine what it would have been like for Sacagawea and a nursing baby. Remember, Little Pomp was only like 7 or 8 months old as they were crossing the Bitterroots. No formula, no children's Tylenol, no baby wipes, no disposable diapers, no Coco Melon or puppy dog pals. Just a very capable and evidently tough as hell Sacagawea. And she absolutely made it work. The more I learn about this young lady, the more impressed I get. Now, as nice as I'm sure it was to be out of the mountains, the general health of the expedition didn't improve none. Matter of fact, thanks to feasting on the roots and fish provided by the Nez Perce, their health actually got much worse. Once again, according to Stephen Ambrose, I know I keep quoting him a lot, but I'm telling you, Undaunted Courage is an excellent book. If you get a chance, pick it up. According to Stephen Ambrose, quote, "For over a week, the expedition resembled a hospital ward for the critically ill more than it did a platoon of fighting men. Herein lies one of the great stories of American history, even though it's a tale of what didn't happen rather than what did. It would have been the work of a few minutes only for the Nez Perce to kill the white men and take for themselves all the expedition's goods. Had the Indians done so, they would have come into possession of by far the biggest arsenal, not just west of the Rocky Mountains, but west of the Mississippi River, along with priceless kettles, axes, hatchets, beads, and other trade items in quantities greater than any of them would have ever seen in their lifetimes. Like the Shoshones, the Nez Perce had no contact with whites, other than some cheap trade goods that had reached them from the Columbia River tribes. They only had one or two inferior rifles. They were constantly harassed by their neighbors who did have guns, especially by Blackfeet when the Nez Perce made their annual trip over the mountains to Buffalo Country. The Nez Perce were hardly oblivious to this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. According to their oral history tradition, when they first met Clark and his six hunters, who had gorged themselves on roots and fish and gotten dysentery, they considered killing them for their weapons. They were dissuaded by a woman named Watkuwais, meaning return from a far country. She had been captured by Blackfeet some 6 or 7 years earlier, taken into Canada, and sold to a white trader. She lived with them, among other traders, for several years before somehow finding her way back home. The traders had treated her much better than the Blackfeet had done, so when Clark arrived, she told the warriors, "These are the people who helped me. Do them no harm." First Sacagawea, now Watkuwais. The expedition owed more to Indian women than either captain ever acknowledged, and the United States owed more to the Nez Perce for their restraint than it ever acknowledged. When, in 1877, the Army, carrying out government policy, drove Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce from their Idaho home, there were in the band old men and women who had, as children, been in Twisted Hair's village. End quote. And well said, Mr. Ambrose. It is a damn shame how the Nez Perce were treated later on. And Twisted Hair, by the way, was the name of the Nez Perce chief who took the expedition in. Not to be confused by his rebellious sister, who just kept walking around telling everybody how she wasn't gonna quote-unquote take it anymore. But yeah, once again, the Corps of Discovery had lucked out. You know, first they were welcomed with open arms by the Mandan, then the Shoshones, the Salish, and now the Nez Perce. Just like Mr. Ambrose stated, during each of these encounters, it would have been child's play for the natives to overpower the expedition, especially once they were among the Nez Perce and in such a weakened state. That said, credit where credit's due. Luck had its part, for sure, as did the generosity of the indigenous. But at the same time, you cannot discount the leadership of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. Yeah, there were some issues with insubordination early on, but by the time they were crossing the Rockies, the captains had managed to transform the Corps of Discovery into a tight group of highly disciplined and unified soldiers. Sure, they'd stick their dick in anything with a pulse, and yeah, maybe none of them had touched a bar of soap in over a year, but by God, they would follow their captains to hell and back. Or to Idaho. Not once during that hump over the mountains did anyone second-guess the leadership or disobey an order or insist on turning back. And I think that's saying something. Also, you gotta keep in mind that they had only lost one man so far, Sergeant Floyd. And his death from a ruptured appendix could have happened anywhere. Did the stars align just right for the Corps of Discovery? Yes. Were they highly dependent upon the goodwill of their Native American hosts? Also yes. But luck and brotherly kindness can only get you so far. Love them or hate them, imperfect though they may be, both Meriwether Lewis and William Clark were excellent leaders, and their leadership was a key ingredient to the expedition's success. Now, like I said, they spent several days there with the Nez Perce recuperating. Many of Dr. Rush's thunderclappers were ingested, and once Clark was back on his feet, he set about making some canoes. This, too, was accomplished with the help of the Nez Perce. Finally, on October 7th, it was time to head out once more. Corps of Discovery would leave their horses in the care of the Nez Perce as they set off down the Clearwater in their brand new canoes. Now, old Toby, the Shoshone who had helped them cross the mountains, he was still with them at this point, but not for long. A few days later, he decided to return to his people. Luckily, the captains had new guides in the aforementioned chief, Twisted Hair, and another chief that went by Ted Oharski. Matter of fact, Twisted Hair and Ted Oharski would travel ahead of the expedition and help to smooth things over with the other tribes, explaining that the strange pale faces came in peace. The mere presence of Sacagawea and Little Pomp also had a calming effect on the natives. I guess they figured that nobody was dumb enough to bring a little baby along on a war party. After a few days, on October 10th, they reached the Snake River, right there on the present-day Idaho-Washington border as they continued to meet and trade with various local tribes, including peoples such as the Yakima and Walla Wallas. Not looking to waste valuable time hunting for game, the Corps had instead taken to trading with the locals for their food, mostly in the form of puppy dogs. Got to imagine that made Lewis's dog Seaman mighty nervous. The expedition continued following the Snake south through what's now Washington State until it met the much-anticipated Columbia River. just north of the present-day border with Oregon. And despite being on the river, or I guess due to being on the river, it was rough going. They were hitting rapids, sometimes several in a day, and supplies were both damaged and lost. On October 19th, Clark wrote of seeing the Cascade Mountains in the distance, and by the 23rd, the expedition reached the Great Falls of the Columbia, known nowadays as Celio Falls, about 100 or so miles east of present-day Portland. It was around this time that the two Nez Perce chiefs, Twisted Hair and Tetaharsky, bid the Corps adieu. The Chinookan people who inhabited this land they were now in were enemies of the Nez Perce, so I guess the chiefs figured they'd get while the getting was still good. Nevertheless, they had helped out the expedition immensely, and the same thing goes for these Chinooks. They would provide the Corps with dried fish and even more dogs, along with valuable info on river conditions, and even help the men portage their equipment around dangerous rapids. Lewis would even trade for a Chinook canoe, stating that they were, quote, neater than any I had ever seen and calculated to ride the waves and carry immense burdens, end quote. Now, I'm no expert, but from what I understand, these Chinookan people, or Chinook, were a confederation of several different tribes or bands who spoke the Chinookan language. Tribes like the Chinook, Wasco, and pushing further west, the Clatsop. These would primarily be the people that the Corps of Discovery would be living among for around the next 6 months. While mostly friendly and willing to help, the expedition would have issues with these tribes attempting to steal from them, mostly in the form of petty theft. You know, supposedly if one of the explorers set a tool or any other object on the ground unattended, the locals would just take it. This happened so often that the captains would eventually have to restrain the men from retaliating with violence. A prudent choice considering that they would need to travel back through this same area on the return trip. As always, I do feel the need to point out that we only have one side of the story here, and the Corps of Discovery wasn't above a little petty thievery themselves. You know, I hate to be a both sides kind of guy, but whether it was some as trivial as taking split wood without leaving a payment, or, as we'll soon discuss, a canoe, when it came to the Corps of Discovery and the Chinooks, it doesn't appear that either party were completely innocent when it came to theft. More on that in a bit. As the expedition made their way down the Columbia, they continued to brave numerous waterfalls and rapids until, at long last, on November 7th, 1805, Clark would record that they were finally in sight of the Great Pacific Ocean. As it turns out, he was wrong. What he actually saw was just the estuary of the Columbia, but why split hairs? Close enough, right? It had taken nearly a year and a half, but the Corps of Discovery had finally made it to the West Coast. Now all they had to do was survive the winter and get the hell back home, preferably with their scalp locks still intact. And that's where we're going to go ahead and wrap things up this week. Too bad the men of the expedition didn't wrap things up, and maybe their peckers wouldn't be leaking pus. You know what I mean? Thank you so much for listening. If you're enjoying this series, if it's bringing some type of value to your life, educational or just entertainment wise, please consider heading on over to buymeacoffee.com/wildwest and buy me a coffee or two or 10. I like mine black, by the way, hot and black. By the way, that's just for the people who can afford it. Okay. Don't go smashing open your kid's piggy bank on my account. The money does for sure help me to keep doing what I'm doing, but there are many other ways to support the Wild West extravaganza without reaching into your pocket. One of the best ways you can help, honestly, is just to share the Wild West extravaganza with others. Send links to your friends, post it on social media, whatever works for you. I truly do appreciate it all. Thanks again for listening, and please join me here next week as we continue with the Corps of Discovery. What will these scamps get up to on the West Coast? Till then, remember, syphilis is making a comeback. According to the CDC, numbers are higher now in the United States than they have been in decades. So all you single people and swingers, I would suggest act accordingly. Adios. Booty hole.